From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack.
And I'm Emma Ray Stein.
We are excited to be back with you to share our weekly review of Connections. What's up first, Emma Ray?
We'll start off this week's podcast with a discussion about sepsis. Maybe you've heard about the infection, but if you're like us, maybe you don't have a good understanding of it or how severe it can be. Sepsis occurs when chemicals released in the bloodstream to fight an infection trigger inflammation throughout the body. This causes a domino effect, sometimes damaging organs and, in some cases, even leading to death.
A local woman named Lynn Lubecki says the staff at Highland Hospital recognized immediately that she had sepsis when she went to the emergency room. And without their training, she says she wouldn't be alive today. Here's her story. She actually sent us an email about all of this, and we invited her on the program to share it.
My sister and I went to meet some old friends. We went out, had dinner, had drinks, fun time, you know, and then we came back home. And I got everybody settled where they had to go. And so people crashed in the house and went to sleep. I remember the last thought I remember having was to not disturb anyone. And that's important because the rest of the night, about a half an hour after everybody was settled, I started to feel very odd. I tried to go to bed and I wasn't comfortable. I was in pain. Probably part of that was the kidney stone acting up. But it was also, which is what we'll talk about in a minute, but I couldn't complete my thoughts. And I went into a back room that's kind of separated from the house and tried to lay down, struggled with laying down, and I had a series of crazy things happen through the night. I had fallen. I was going back and forth to a bathroom quietly throwing up. I had to go to the bathroom a lot, and I went back upstairs to try to sleep and then quietly went back downstairs and didn't say anything to anyone.
What did you think was happening?
I had, the first time I went upstairs, I just said, I think something's wrong. Maybe I'm having an appendix attack. And that is the last conscious thought I have. And I don't know what happened. And all I thought is, this is going to get better. This will be better. Maybe I ate something. And it was just this strange thing. And then by the time morning came, I had gone upstairs three times to try to settle, removed myself and isolated myself into a room. And then when everyone started getting up, I went upstairs and tried to rest. And I couldn't. So I was up and down from the upstairs to the downstairs, engaging with my family who they knew something was wrong.
Are you trying to sort of pass it off as normal as possible?
That's my MO. That's what I do.
That's kind of what we do when we're all sick, right? I mean, we think like, well, I'll be fine. Don't worry about me. Right.
I have all these people in the house. I want to try to keep things rolling, but I something was so wrong and I couldn't even help myself by saying, I'm going somewhere. Somebody help me. I just continued on that way for a while until the final time I went upstairs and then downstairs to try to re-engage with people. And then I started to shake, and I refused to go to the hospital because I was too cold. And they're looking like, something's funny here. So we went to the urgent care at around 3:30 in the afternoon. And when we went there, I had to run out of the urgent care, and I was throwing up in the parking lot. I was just running to corners right on Monroe Avenue. It was really scary. And then they took me in, and my memory is that I was being guided to the bathroom, and I missed the door, and so I was in full confusion. I didn't know. I couldn't take in the information, and I couldn't give any information. And so fortunately, I was with someone who could. You know, my partner helped. But it was terrible. And the nurse, when she took some vitals, recognized that something was off. My blood pressure and my heart rate, there was something there she went to get the doctor, and when the doctor came in, the next thing I remember is being in the ambulance and then going into the emergency department at Highland Hospital.
Why don't I hand it over to Dr. Tim Lum, who you saw Lynn that day.
Yes.
And how did she present to you? What's going through your mind?
So in some respects, Lynn made it a little bit easy for me in terms of presenting as sepsis. When she arrived, a very astute triage nurse in the emergency department called me and said, I've got a woman who just came in by ambulance and she looks sick. And when we say in the emergency department someone means sick, that's kind of our way of saying you're really sick.
It's serious.
Right. I recall meeting Lynn up at triage, still on the ambulance gurney, and recognizing by virtue of vital signs and just the general appearance, sometimes our gestalt matters here, that this woman is sick. Her heart rate's elevated. Her blood pressure's down. Those are two specific vital signs that are often we find in sepsis, if not severe sepsis. And she had a fever and she had chills by description. So we knew that we needed to get her back to her room immediately and essentially proceed to treat this as sepsis. So I believe I saw her essentially within a minute of arrival and then spent a considerable amount of the next, you know, X part of an hour trying to help her out.
Now, by some measures here, this is the third leading cause of death in the United States after heart disease and cancer, and many of us, me included, wouldn't have been able to really even define it. 258,000 deaths per year. Mm-hmm. Now, again, we'll talk about it's a little more complicated because it often comes at the tail end of other ailments, but still understanding that, what is sepsis?
I like to keep it simple. That sepsis is a potentially life-threatening condition that is part of the body's response to an infection. Mm-hmm. So it starts with an infection, and in the course of your body trying and your immune system trying to combat the infection, there's a lot of chemicals released that are trying to help with grapple with the infection that can cause some issues really at the cellular level. And in a sense, the response of your body to trying to treat the infection can really get out of balance and cause some damage to entire organ systems, to the kidneys, the brain, the central nervous system.
Next, the story of a bike accident in Rochester has made international news. Brian Agnello was out riding his bike when a driver hit him from behind. Full disclosure, Brian is our colleague at WXXI.
The driver claims that Agnello was going 80 miles an hour on his bike. That's 17 miles faster than the record-breaking speed at the Tour de France. Now that driver is expecting Agnello to pay $700 for damages to the car. Here's Brian telling his story.
I was on a little ride that I usually do every night, just taking a left on Canterbury to hit the Harvard Bike Boulevard, and I was hit from behind. Very surreal feeling when you get hit by that much steel. Just an average night.
Did you think anything immediately? I mean, were you able to process what was happening? Did you know right away what exactly was happening?
I kind of guessed that it was a car. Didn't quite know where I was at first. Like I told News 8 that I felt like I was under the car for a moment, which was terrifying. And then when I landed and woke up, I went, oh, all right. I did the quick self-check. I'm all here. Heard the ambulance coming, and just the night was just a blur.
So, I mean, it literally sounds like in that moment you had to make sure, and I know this sort of might sound cliche or trite, but you're making sure, like, I'm alive here.
Yes.
You were doing that. Okay. Mm-hmm. You were wearing a helmet, as you always do.
Yes.
And you told City News that that would have been the end of your head if not for the helmet. You hit the head pretty hard on the hood or the windshield?
The helmet was destroyed. It impacted and gave way as the injected helmets do.
Okay. Yeah. So I suspect you're grateful for that piece of equipment.
Yes. That's actually, I'm going to say that is most of the reason why I'm here and why I don't have head damage or brain damage at this time.
Do you have scrapes, other bumps, bruises?
My knuckles healed up, my face abrasions have healed up, and my leg pain's gone. All the imaging showed everything's perfect, everything's in line, nothing's out of line, nothing's broken, and very lucky.
Did you think at that point, well, hey, at least maybe that someone will pay for a new bike here? Did you think you were going to get recouped anything?
I expected the insurance to do its job, which they did. I never had...
What does that mean, by the way?
Oh, the insurance of the driver covered the cost of the damaged property, the medical bills, the hospital, the ambulance ride. His insurance company was great with handling with me and contacting me and taking care of everything.
We don't say that often. This is a very exciting moment. The insurance company did a great job and did what they were supposed to do.
Yeah, I was very pleased.
We should ask which insurance company. This is very exciting.
Geico.
Geico. Okay, so you got a new bike.
Yes.
And by the way, is that the wrong term? Is it bicycle? Because sometimes we say bikes.
Bicycle, bike.
Okay, I just
cycle.
Want to make sure, only because if you say bike, sometimes people think motorcycle. We're talking about a bicycle. Mm-hmm. What did you get, by the way?
I got a Salsa Journeyman. That's one of their new touring bikes they released. It's the 2020 model. I just bought it over the weekend in Lake Placid at the High Peak Cyclery.
You feel pretty good about it?
Oh, yeah. I feel great. I got on the thing. It just felt awesome. It's got everything and more that I'll need to do my cross-country trip.
Did you have any hesitation about getting back on a bicycle after that?
I did not. I was on a bicycle 2 days after the crash. Kind of had to work out a little muscle pain in my right calf, but bicycling is the best physical therapy one can do with leg pain. It's amazing. I got on, I just felt like a new person.
Your colleagues around the table are smiling, and we'll talk to them as we kind of broaden the conversation about this, the culture in the city, and where this is, and if Brian's story is telling in any way, or perhaps is it more of a one-off. This could have been over with that. I mean, the insurance did its job, you're okay, you've got a new bicycle, you're moving on. When did you find out you were getting sued?
It was about four, how did I say, oh God, when was that? Four weeks after the initial crash, just out of the blue, I got a piece of mail. And I got home, opened it, and well, if you would have loved to have been a fly on the wall at that moment. It was quite surprising.
This is family-friendly radio.
Yes, I understand.
Watch your language.
I understand.
You were surprised, I guess.
I was. I was very surprised. I couldn't believe it. Immediately called.
Well, what did it tell you? That you damaged the car, therefore you got to pay. He wanted you to pay $700.
Yes, yeah, because I fell into his windshield and caused
damage. As one does when they're going 80 miles an hour on a bike and hit by a car.
Yeah. I'd have to say the safety glass of the windshield is a lot more forgiving than pavement.
Okay. So, but in that moment, as frustrated as you are, you've had to figure out what you're going to do about this. And I wonder if you can sort of fill in the listeners on what it has been like, because this kind of claim, you don't know what's going to happen in a courtroom. What's gone on since you got that notice in the mail?
Oh, I constantly think about it. I mean, the story just keeps getting more and more ridiculous, every account that comes out. And I'm not really worried about it. I know I will go in, present my case. I've got the folder of evidence, and hopefully the judge looks at this and goes, yeah, we're just going to drop it. And hopefully it just goes away and everyone just goes on with their lives. I'd like to see the driver who hit me at least get ticketed, or at least have to pay some sort of fine, or it all depends on the judge and how the judge hears it. And
when's that going to happen?
March 25th, 9:30 in the morning at City Courthouse over on 99 Exchange.
Unless the driver decides to rescind that claim. Right?
Or not show up. Yeah.
Or not show up. Which is possible, because this is now a story that's gotten attention. I mean, the other day, you're walking by my office, you just got off the phone with who, the New York Post?
Yes.
Talked to the New York Post. I've seen your story shared in social media far and wide. I have friends in other states going, what's going on in Rochester? Your story has kind of gone places.
It's gone as far as News Corp in Australia. It's reached there, and I found an article in Finland this morning. So it's circulating. It's also circulating around countries that value cycling on a daily basis, that people do this every day to get to work. Their kids get to school on bicycles, and they're looking at the U.S. going, why? What's going on over there? Why are motorists so against, or why did they get so angry at cyclists? Why is this a culture here? Why are we in such a car-centric culture? Why can't we all just get along and coexist on the roadways? That's the big question.
We'll end the week with a conversation with a talented local artist and basketball player. Britton Bradford grew up idolizing Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan. And as an African-American youth, he thought careers in rap or professional sports were his only paths to success. He says he didn't know that being an artist was an option.
Bradford has become a role model in his community, and he hopes that he can use his visibility to show young African-American men that there are many ways to make your voice heard, not just through language. Let's listen.
I graduated from School of the Arts, and I ended up going to MCC, where I would continue like my degree in arts and graphic design. And I ended up playing basketball for them that year. I'm pretty sure we finished, was it fifth in the nation for the NGCAA. You know, I took some time after that, I guess, to just kind of put myself in a different headspace. And then I kind of revisited basketball and ended up playing professionally for a few, or semi-professionally for a few different teams. You know, I've done like some NBA D-League stuff, mm-hmm. Played in some tournaments down in New York, some NBA guys.
Competition's amazing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's completely different. I would definitely say, though, that Rochester basketball is a lot different than New York basketball.
How so?
We move a lot more than they do in New York. Yeah, New York is kind of, it's a little bit of a show.
Well, a lot of ISO, a lot of hero ball.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rochester's a lot of, you know, fast break, getting up and down the floor. You know, so then those couple years or few years playing pro, I kind of realized, you know, all the time that I had on my hands, and I was saying to myself, you know, I could definitely do something more. And it kind of wasn't really until I came back to Rochester after my first season when a couple of kids that I coached, you know, ran up to me and were like, yo, you know, we want to be like you. We saw, you know, you playing basketball here and there. And I'm like, and in my head, I didn't realize how big it was becoming a role model. I guess I didn't know how many eyes were on me. So kind of in that moment, I realized I have to be more than just a basketball player.
So when those kids are saying, we want to do what you're doing, what's going through your mind? Are you thinking, no, you don't? Or are you thinking?
My mind was blown. Only because that's something that, you know, I remember, you know, meeting NBA guys, and we see those guys, and it's like, whether we said it out loud or not, we're kind of having that thought like, yo, like I'm standing next to, you know, so-and-so, and yep, this is where I want to be, and this is what I want to be like. It really took a minute for me to digest it all, the thoughts of it, of someone, you know, telling me that they want to do something that I'm doing or they want to be in a position that I'm in. Before that, up to that point, I had never really experienced that. And like I said, it just kind of, at that moment, changed my mindset. Because now I realize how many eyes around me, how many people are seeing what I'm doing, the type of person that I have to kind of become, and, you know, doing more than just basketball. And that was when the art kind of stood out. Because I could always, you know, I always drew and painted because, you know, school of the arts. But it wasn't until I got, like I said, older and came back after that season that I realized, and I kind of sat with myself, and I said, well, what else can I do? Because I don't really want to work for other people. You know, I don't want to punch a clock. And the art was the answer for me.
Why in that moment, when those students are looking at you and sort of admiring what you're doing and saying, I want to be like you, why do you think in your own mind you went beyond basketball? Why wasn't basketball enough at that moment?
Because I immediately kind of went back to my childhood and seeing and really seeing these basketball players and telling myself, like, this is what I want to be, but not really getting their full story, so to a degree, you know. Like, you know, the superstars, we know those stories. But there are other basketball players, you know, other guys in the league who were our favorite players who we would see. We didn't really know the entire story behind, you know, why they were who they were, how they got here, what else they're doing, you know. And these are our role models. And like I said, at that moment, it just became, what else can I do? What more can I do? Because my biggest thing with anything in life is, you know, obtaining knowledge for the purpose of passing it on. So how could I build something more than just athletics and show other people that, you know, everything is, even if you want to do this, you still have to be more than what this is. And there are other options. There are other things you can do.
Most pro and semi-pro athletes who are not at the top level, you know, money's tight, life's tough.
Oh, yeah.
It can be hard. Was it tough?
Yeah, it was definitely tough. You know, you make X amount of dollars. And, you know, when you're younger, you don't really think about, you know, that money continuously coming in. You get it. You're excited to have it. And it's like, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I want to go out. I want to, you know, I want to have fun. And you kind of have to take a step back from yourself and realize, well, this is not as residual as I may think it is. You know, I could get hurt at any moment also.
Yeah,
because I think I spent most of my rookie year, like, on the bench with a knee injury. And that kind of sucked. I'm not going to lie.
You're right. And the money can be gone in a minute.
Oh, yeah.
Do you wish you had thought about something besides basketball earlier in your life?
I honestly can't say that I do. Because, you know, just like with Chris, every experience you have contributes to the person that you are or you're becoming. You change one thing about my past and I'm a different person.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
You can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. She's Megan and I'm Emma Ray. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you on Monday.